Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the front lines in that war, of course, is the Middle East. And I'm very pleased to have with us as our first guest today a man who lives in the Middle East, has studied closely many aspects of the challenges facing Western civilization, notably his own native country, Israel, but also ours, and I think the free world more generally. His name is Dr. Mordechai Kedar. He is the director of the Center for the Study of the Middle East and Islam, a research associate at the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies, a man who is both based at Bar-Ilan University and has been an influential figure there and in Israel for decades. He is a lieutenant colonel, now retired from the Israel Defense Forces, and the author of, among other things, a presentation entitled "Why is the Middle East such a difficult area for Americans and Westerners to understand?" We're going to explore some of the reasons why in the course of our conversation with him. Dr. Kedar, it's so good to have you back, sir. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio once again.
Frank, it is my honor and my pleasure to be here.
Let me ask you first and foremost about a very important study that you and one of our colleagues, David Yerushalmi, collaborated on, I think about a decade ago now. It was published, I believe, by the Middle East Quarterly, and a journalism on terrorism as well. It was an analysis of the Sharia supremacist character of a lot of mosques in the United States. As I recall, roughly 80% of the sample that were sort of on-site inspected by your forensic team. What did that tell us about the presence and influence then of, well, people aligned with this sort of vision of Islam, that it would dominate the world, including, perhaps most importantly, a group called the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, for this, we have to understand the mindset of this organization and the people who are working within its ranks. The Muslim Brotherhood, which was established in Egypt almost 100 years ago, it stands actually on three pillars. One is to get rid of the Western occupation of Islamic countries, like as was in Egypt in those days, occupied or controlled by Britain. The second pillar is to get rid of the culture of the Western culture, which actually settled inside our societies and corrupt our people, and especially our girls and women. And the third is to implement the Sharia law wherever we can, means Muslims. And this is actually the three pillars on which this Muslim Brotherhood ideology is based on. And when they migrate to other countries, they actually adjust this ideology to the situation in the exile where they go to. But in order to understand this, Hijra means migration in Arabic. It doesn't mean that you go from your homeland to another land which you are a guest in. Their mindset is to follow the Prophet Muhammad, who migrated from Mecca to Medina and made Medina into his homeland. Means the homeland is the country which they go to. And this is totally different from the mindset of the West, which sees the homeland where you were born and you migrate to other countries. No, here they migrate to the homeland. And in order to arrange the homeland, the new homeland, in a way which will be compliant to their expectations as Muslims, they have to change the regime, they have to change the system, they have to change the atmosphere in order in order to the culture, in order to make sure that the new homeland fits their expectations of living in an Islamic environment. And this is actually what the Muslim Brotherhood are trying to do in America, in Europe, in anywhere where they migrate to.
And as you know so well, Dr. Mordechai Kadar, their literal translation of the word Islam is submission in Arabic. And it is this purpose, getting us all to submit to Sharia, that is at the core of this Muslim Brotherhood philosophy. So when you see, by some estimates, 80% of the mosques in this survey that you sampled, I believe it was 100 in total, so a very high percentage, there were evidence of ties in many of these cases to the Brotherhood and to its agenda. The reason I wanted to introduce the topic this way is we've seen Muslim Brotherhood front organizations, many of them associated with these mosques, others promoting them and the like, but we've seen them engage very aggressively in the course of the 2020 election in support of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris's candidacies. And it seems now as though with the putative victory of the Biden-Harris campaigns, that the Muslim Brotherhood is getting rewarded for that support with, among other things, personnel placements, notably a fellow by the name of Maher Bitter as the head of intelligence for the National Security Council, who has a long pedigree of activism with the Boycott, Divest, Sanction Israel movement, and also with the UN Relief and Works Institution, the UNRWA, as it's called. To the extent that you're seeing such people, and Linda Sarsour, and the head of CARE, Nihad Awad, and Trita Parsi, the Iranian lobbyist that has been very active during the Biden years, now playing roles in, or certainly influential on, the new U.S. government. Should we be concerned about that?
First of all, my country, Israel, should be very concerned because we share with American intelligence organizations much of the information which we succeed to get and to collect from the Arab countries and especially from Iran. Just for example, the archive of the nuclear military program, which we stole from Iran 2 years ago. So definitely, I'm more than sure that Israel shares the information with American intelligence organizations because we want to work together with them. And actually, when I was in the intelligence for 25 years, we definitely cooperated with American counterparts of our unit, and definitely we shared information, we shared many things.
Dr. Kadar, hold that thought, please. We have to take just a short break. We'll be right back with more on the other side of this very brief break with Dr. Mordechai Kadar of the Center for the Study of the Middle East and Islam, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting for another segment with Dr. Mordechai Kadar, a brilliant analyst and, well, policy practitioner, I think it's fair to say, in the past, at least in his native Israel. He is the director of the Center for the Study of the Middle East and Islam. We're talking with him a bit about what's been going on in terms of the rise of Muslim Brotherhood influences in America and now inside the Biden-Harris administration. And Dr. Kadar, you were talking a bit about how having people that Israel would find deeply hostile to it inside the wire, as it were, of the U.S. government would impact, among other things, intelligence sharing. Finish that thought, if you would, and then I want to talk about the policy implications of all this.
Yeah, you mentioned the Bitar guy who is from Palestinian origin, who became the liaison between the National Security Council of the United States and the 16 or 17 intelligence organizations. He actually is in the junction of all the information which comes from the intelligence organizations to the government. And you mentioned that this is, it might be a bit of a problem because somebody who is associated with the Muslim Brotherhood and with this, such a background, what does it mean that he sits actually in all the most classified information of the United States? And definitely we Israelis are very concerned about this because everything which we will give means, so after all, we do cooperate with the American intelligence. We give them information, they give us. And here we are, whatever we collect will come to this man and he will see, and who knows what he's going to do with this. After all, he is a member or activist in very, very anti-Israeli activity. So what does it mean? But let me tell you, Frank, the problem is not so much in this guy, the Bitar guy. I'm much more concerned about his superiors, means the Secretary of State and many others, who are actually going now to have a whole wedding with the Iranians. They are going to sit with the Iranians to negotiate how America crawls back into the JCPOA, how America is lifting the sanctions. And they are going to sit with the Iranian buddies day and night, as they did in 2015 when they worked on the JCPOA. They are much more dangerous when it comes to Israel because they have the information. They have the clandestine intelligence, what we give them. And they actually going to sit now with the Iranians, knowing everything which we gave them about Iran. And what do you think? They will keep it as a secret between us and them?
This is just one of the problems, of course, just lifting up the Iranian regime again after the Trump administration both withdrew from this appalling negotiated deal that many of these same people were involved in during the previous administration, the Obama administration, is worrying as well. Sort of rehabilitating the Iranians is very worrying. And let's talk about that in the context of two aspects of your particular portfolio, Dr. Kedar. One is, of course, Israel itself. What are the implications for your country, given that we're talking about its most mortal enemy at the moment, the Iranian regime? Point one and point two, the implications of this kind of resumption of the close affinity with Iran that was, I think, rejected by Trump in favor of a new approach that brought about peace agreements, warm peace agreements at that, with your country and a number of important Arab nations or Muslim nations. Give us your thought on both the implications for Israel itself and for the so-called Abraham Accords of this policy shift.
Well, let me tell you, Frank, one Iranian missile, which will fall in the desert of Abu Dhabi and will do no damage at all, will be a very powerful hint to the Emiratis that they went forward with Israel too much, for the Iranians to accept it. Only one missile will be enough. And the Iranians, empowered by the Americans, empowered by the American administration, might very possibly do it because they actually have already done it in Saudi Arabia in mid-September of 2019, when they attacked in one night two major facilities of the oil production of the Saudis. They brought a giant damage, and they got along with this. Nothing happened to them. And neither the Americans nor the Saudis, nobody retaliated. And the Saudis learned the lesson that you don't mess with the Iranians. And now the Emiratis might go through such a thing as well. But let me tell you something. It's not only Israel's problem. Before Israel's problem, it is the people of Iran, the citizens, the poor citizens of Iran, who have to suffer under the yoke of their own regime. And here I come with a very, very you know, a question which definitely boggles my mind. The Democratic Party, which present itself as the herald of human rights and political freedoms, cooperates overwhelmingly with a regime of oppressors, of people who crash demonstrations in the streets, you know, a regime which is, at least reportedly, women, when they are being arrested for demonstrating in the streets, are being raped, you know, in masses in this, in Iran. What is the matter with such an administration which cooperates with such a regime of Iran before Israel?
To say nothing of its support for terrorism and the destruction that that has left in its wake around the world, including the loss of an awful lot of American lives.
Of course, you know, and the Democratic Party, which presents itself as a party which protects the human rights all over the world, only when it comes to Iran, they forget about the Iranian citizen human rights. This is one thing. Second thing, as you know, Iran is made of many nationalities, not only Persian. There are Baluchis and there are Arabs and Azeris and Kurds and Turkmens and Qashqais and Luris and many others. They are all oppressed under the Persian-Iranian occupation, as they call it. But nobody cares. Nobody knows. How many people in the United States know about the Iranian society, which never became one Iranian nation? It is Iranian state which occupied, you know, the Azeris and the Baluchis and the Kurds and all the others. And who cares? And this is what boggles my mind, that people who present themselves as protectors of human rights and national rights, as they do in many other places in the world, when it comes to Iran, they just shut their eyes, close their ears, in order not to hear and see the reality of Iran.
It's very much at the core of the problem. You're absolutely right. But let me broaden the lens a little bit, because a similar blind spot is applied to the Palestinians. Is it not? You have a regime that has long since lost its electoral mandate, but it holds on to power on the so-called West Bank, Judea and Samaria, the Palestinian Authority, and you have Hamas in Gaza. And both of these are horrifically oppressive to their own people, as well as threatening to Israelis and others. And yet again, we see this blind spot. Just quickly, from your perspective in Israel, but obviously looking at the rest of the region as well, what is the implication of a new administration under Joe Biden, evidently determined to restore to the central position in the Middle East the Palestinian cause and the whole idea of imposing, I think, a two-state solution, as it's called, on Israel?
Look, first of all, there are already two states, Israel and the Hamastan in Gaza. So, and Gaza is a state. From every point of view, is a state. They have a government, they have an army, they have police, they know how to produce projectiles, and then they know how to, okay, so from every factual point of view, Gaza as a state functions way much better than Syria, Iraq, Sudan, Yemen, Libya combined. Okay, so they're already a Palestinian state in Gaza. Now there are all kinds of people who say that we need another Palestinian state, because Gaza and the West Bank will never be together, because Gaza is under Hamas and nobody will come to Gaza in order to chase Hamas out. And we have to get used to this idea, because Hamas took Gaza over more than 13 and a half years ago, exactly. 13 and a half years ago, and this state named Gaza functions perfectly. Okay? So now what do they want? Another state in Judea and Samaria, which might become another Hamastan, either by elections, as already happened in 2006, or by coup d'etat, as happened in Gaza in 2007. Nobody can deny this possibility. So what do you need? Another terror state? And this is what, the American administration now think that, we will support Abu Mazen, we'll give some money, and he will succeed to buy everybody and to bribe everybody and to be, you know, another failing Arab regime, as it was in Syria, Iraq, Libya, or Yemen. And this is the problem. They don't see beyond the moment. They don't understand that these countries actually fall apart because they are heterogeneous societies comprised of many clans. And this is why I came out with a new plan of a peace between us and the Palestinians by creating 8 Palestinian emirates based on the clans of the cities, one in Hebron and one in Gaza already exists.
We are hard out of time. This is a topic to which we will return with you soon, if we may, because clearly there is a new appetite in Washington for fooling around with this Palestinian problem. It needs to be done constructively and not simply destructively, which is, I'm afraid, what is likely otherwise. Come back to us again soon, if you would, sir. Thank you very much for your time today and your terrific expertise. We appreciate your visiting so much. Next up, we will speak with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry about a whole nother set of problems, our electric grid and what might happen to it that would be potentially catastrophic for all of us.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and I am very pleased always to be able to say welcome to a good friend and colleague of many years, a man I've come to admire tremendously for his indefatigable efforts to try to protect all of us against the perils of a collapse or takedown, as the case may be, of a piece of critical infrastructure upon which we all depend completely. And that is our electric grid. His name is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. He has served our country in a number of capacities as an analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency, as a member of the professional staff of the House Armed Services Committee, and as a member and staff director of a really indispensable congressionally appointed Blue Ribbon Commission aimed at addressing the threat of electromagnetic pulse, specifically to our electric grid and everything that depends upon it, which is not only each of us, basically, but all of the other aspects of our critical infrastructure. Peter is the author of numerous books, including most recently The Power and the Light, the Congressional EMP Commission's War to Save America. Peter Pry, it's great to have you back. Welcome. Happy New Year to you, such as it is.
Yes, such as it is. Thank you for having me, Frank.
It's always a delight. Peter, I want to get into a breaking news item that's gotten a lot of people very concerned. But before we get turned to that, let's just set the stage a little bit. For our audience, I think people are fairly conversant in this, but just to level set, what is the nature of the vulnerability that our current electric grid has that you have been trying so manfully for so long to remedy?
Well, I think the EMP Commission put on the national security map raised consciousness about the fact that the electric grid is the keystone critical infrastructure upon which everything else depends. And that if that goes down, that you will end up losing all the other life-sustaining critical infrastructures that make electronic civilization possible and to sustain the lives of 330 million Americans. You know, telecommunications, food and water even depend directly or indirectly on the electric grid, transportation, everything, our military forces, and moreover, that our adversaries, Russia, China, North Korea, even Iran, have got in their military doctrines, have this not just theory, but plans for a new way of warfare that's focused on attacking the electric grid. They believe it's the most decisive revolution in military affairs in history, this concept. General Vladimir Shevchenko first put the idea out a few decades ago in a book called No Contact Wars. And what he means by that is that you can win World War III without having to have contact with an adversary's military forces. Because if you take down the U.S. electric grid, our ability to project military power and sustain military operations also collapses. The whole civilization collapses. And you can win basically without having to fight a war in a traditional sense and end up...
And Peter Pry, in addition to having a doctrine, we believe that every single one of those adversaries actually has the capability to do this. And again, very quickly, what is the sort of mechanism by which that takedown of our grid could be accomplished?
Well, the big stick is EMP weapons, which come in both nuclear and non-nuclear varieties, because they have been demonstrated. You know, we know from decades of analysis that both nuclear and non-nuclear weapons, you know, can take down and destroy the transformers, the control systems that that make the grid possible. But that is also in combination in their military doctrine. It's a combined arms kind of planning, and they would use cyber warfare as well as special forces sabotage. So you'd have small teams of saboteurs running around the country, either shooting up or using non-nuclear EMP weapons, you know, to go after the transformers and control systems. And that the combination, you could take down the grid with any one of these things.
Yeah. And your best professional judgment and that of the commission was that this is a very real and present danger, arguably a growing one. One of the things that has been so troubling about this is that so little has been done to this point to try to mitigate these vulnerabilities. Again, notwithstanding your best efforts and those of the commission, I'm reminded of a very important conversation that you had with a man who went on to become president of the United States shortly before he announced his candidacy. I believe it was in June of 2015. Talk a little bit about your private discussion with then businessman Donald Trump and what that helped translate into during his presidency.
Yes. Thanks to you, Frank. I was able to brief then candidate Trump at the Iowa caucuses for about 45 minutes on the threat from EMP, and he understood it, and he wanted to know, you know, why is it that the country hasn't been protected from this existential threat? You know, he was just astonished that this vulnerability was allowed to happen, and I explained that, you know, part of the problem was that there was tremendous resistance from the electric power industry, you know, which has enormously powerful lobbying. They don't want to spend extra money, and they're resistant to protecting the grid against cyber or EMP or sabotage. And also that within the U.S. government itself, you know, nobody wanted to take responsibility for it. You know, the Department of Defense would say, well, an EMP can come from the sun, and therefore it's a natural EMP threat. And the job of Department of Homeland Security, DHS, would say, well, this is could be done by a nuclear weapon or terrorist attack, so it's a DOD responsibility. And the Department of Energy would say, well, you know, the utilities, that their job isn't national security. That depends either on DHS or DOD.
Everybody's pointing the finger at somebody else. So what did Donald Trump do when he came to office based on your insights into this persistent problem?
Well, he delivered on his promise, because at the end of that conversation, he said, Dr. Pry, don't worry. When I'm elected president, we're going to knock their heads together and solve this problem. His exact words. And that's in effect what he did in his March 26, 2019 executive order, you know, to protect an EMP executive order to protect not just the electric grid, but all our critical national infrastructures from natural and man-made EMP. And it was an excellent executive order. It was based on the recommendations of the EMP commissioners, and I myself made contributions to the executive order. It wasn't entirely perfect. Every executive order has to be negotiated with the bureaucracy. You know, there were some foreseeable problems in it, where the Department of Energy, for example, you know, was given the responsibility of EMP waveforms, and that one flaw in it ended up in a lot of ways giving DOE and Obama holdovers in the Department of Homeland Security the opportunity to sabotage that executive order and slow roll it. So it got held up for an entire year just over the question about, well, how serious is the EMP threat? Because they wanted to lowball the threat so that the utilities would have to do almost nothing. And just before the president left office, we won that battle. And the Department of Defense waveforms, you'd think it would just be common sense that the Department of Defense waveforms would be the waves you would use. You know, these are the waveforms that the best scientists, guys like Dr. Graham and George Baker and Bill Radaski and dozens of others came up with, and that the Department of Defense had been using to protect military systems for 50 years, based on experimentation, including high-altitude nuclear tests and tests that we could observe the Russians performing. We had some Russian data. And so it would just seem that just such a matter of common sense that from day one we would have used those waveforms, but no.
We got that agreed at the end of the administration, but one other thing happened a few months before, Peter. Talk about that second executive order, because that brings us to the topic I wanted to ask you quickly about.
Right. The executive order to secure the U.S. bulk power system, which was another executive order, really, that I think was inspired by the work of the EMP Commission. And that was, and also people were sensitized to our dependence on foreign sources of pharmaceuticals from China, because during the COVID crisis, and that said, and they said, well, you know, if it's not a good idea to be dependent on China for pharmaceuticals, you know, maybe it's not a good idea to be dependent on China for critical equipment vital to the operation of the electric grid. And that, too, is just common sense. You know, would you trust China to make our fighter aircraft and our aircraft carriers? Of course not. 330 million Americans' lives depend on the electric grid.
So the president said we don't want foreign equipment in our grids, clearly had in mind this hostile power of China. And there are reports, Peter, that there is such equipment in the grid right now. I've heard one estimate, which sounds astonishing, that there's as many as 200 of our transformers that are Chinese made, in addition to presumably SCADA control systems and chips and the like. To the extent that that's the case, this executive order was designed to try to remove those pieces of equipment. But we've just learned that one of the decisions that was made in rapid fire succession, one of the executive orders issued by President Biden, would, if not countermand that executive order by President Trump, at least put it on hold for 90 days. And Peter, we have to take a short break. We're going to come back and continue this conversation with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and we'll find out what that executive order by the Biden administration would do and its implications and more, especially as they relate to perhaps your life and that of your loved ones. Straight ahead, more with Peter Pry.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're visiting with one of the foremost experts in America on a whole host of national security challenges we face, and most especially, he has been the leading public exponent of the idea that we must protect our most critical of critical infrastructures, our electric grid, from hostile action or natural events. His name is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. And he is a frequent guest on this program. We're always appreciative of his time, but most especially at a moment when there is a, well, teachable opportunity, I guess one might say. Barack Obama would use that phrase a lot, about the vulnerabilities of our electric grid and what we must do about it. And Peter, we were talking before the break about the degree to which we may have built into our grid certain vulnerabilities to the extent that we've allowed a hostile power like communist China to put equipment that we are now relying upon to help operate the grid. President Trump, late in his administration, issued an executive order saying, you know, we don't want such foreign equipment in the grid. Assess what's there and let's get it out of there and don't put more in. That's all been put on hold, we've just learned, by the new Biden-Harris administration in an executive order that Joe Biden signed this past week. Talk a bit about that new executive order and its implications as you see them.
Sure. The Trump administration, didn't want us to have control systems or transformers from foreign sources, and particularly China, in the U.S. electric grid, because they could have logic bombs or have backdoor entryway for cyber attacks, or might even be deliberately designed to be more vulnerable to EMP than is necessary, and therefore set us up for collapsing our electric grid and all our other life-sustaining critical infrastructures in a World War III. And the bad guys would be able to win World War III without having to fight the Marines or the Navy or the Air Force. And it's such a common sense thing. It's really surprising that the Biden administration, although there's a lot of differences, but it's really surprising that the Biden administration would give such high priority to retracting that particular executive order. And their first week of being president, it's so surprising and astonishing that I actually got a call from London TV and did an interview on London TV yesterday, because they thought, what is this all about? Why would the president do that as one of the most important things? And, part of my answer to that was, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, big utilities, NERC is basically a lobby for the 3,000 utilities, never wanted that executive order. And they don't care about national security. They care about costs. And they would rather save a little money, even if the stuff does come from China and puts the lives of the American people at risk, which is the bottom line. So that is one possible explanation as to why Biden would suspend the executive order. But that doesn't really seem to be adequate. For all of NERC's power, it doesn't seem to be that powerful. And another more ominous possibility is, I wonder if the Biden administration, if this portends a sea change in our policy toward China, and that it may be signaling China that, we want to go back to normalcy with China again. And therefore, another enormous accomplishment of the Trump administration, which is finally getting the U.S. government to recognize that China is not merely a competitor, but is an adversary, okay, an enemy, will go away. And indeed, the Biden administration, I heard from CSP's Fred Flights last night on TV interview on Lou Dobbs, mentioned that the Biden administration wants to change the language that we use toward China and start describing them again as a competitor and not as an adversary.
Avril Haines, the new director of national intelligence, I'm not quite sure whether she's been confirmed yet or not, but she will be, presumably, used that formulation in her testimony during our confirmation hearing. So that is a straw in the wind for sure. Peter, I did want to ask you about one other thing, but I guess to just tie this off, you would consider it to be a very bad idea, I take it, to end the Trump essentially prohibition on putting more foreign gear in our electric utilities infrastructure, and especially any that comes from China, for the very real national security reasons you've mentioned.
It is such an astonishingly and irresponsible idea that I think it would give better grounds for impeachment of President Biden than any of the fictional grounds that were used against President Trump to launch impeachment. I think that congressional hearings should try to impeach him over it, even if they can't succeed.
Yeah, well, it's unlikely to happen, but at the very least, it is a very important warning to the rest of us, and I think people are beginning to be alive to it. And again, thanks in part to your important work, Peter Pry. Let me turn to one other issue. We're told that President Biden spoke with Vladimir Putin, the dictator of Russia, yesterday, and while the readout from the White House was that they talked about a number of things in which Joe Biden was putatively very robust in criticizing Putin for his handling, for example, of domestic opposition and the like. The real meat of the conversation was an agreement in principle to simply renew for 5 years a treaty between the United States and Russia that was set to expire next week. Tell us about this New START treaty, Peter Pry, and whether it's advisable for us to be essentially just allowing it to continue to govern us, at least for another 5 years.
Right. The New START treaty is supposed to limit the number of strategic long-range nuclear weapons on the sides, the kind of nuclear weapons on ICBMs, strategic bombers, and ballistic missile submarines that can reach the homelands of Russia and the United States, limiting them to 1,550 weapons and 700 bombers and missiles. Those are what the limits are. The State Department claims that the Russians are not violating the New START treaty. And if so, I think that this proves the State Department would fail anyone's basic intelligence test, because the Russians are in violation of every other major treaty, the Chemical and Biological Weapons Convention, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, the Presidential Nuclear Initiative, you know, limiting or that would call for the elimination of tactical nuclear weapons, which, because the Russians have been cheating on that, they've got an at least 10-to-1 advantage, and their Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, which the Russians also have been cheating on and have a very significant advantage, and the U.S. has no INF. But the state claims that that they're not violating, and admits they're violating all those, but not violating New START. And I think that that is due to the fact that the verification provisions in New START, you know, are grossly inadequate. And so that it's easy for them to cheat on. And the state probably agreed to those provisions during the Obama administration, so it wouldn't have to. The State Department is so enamored. It's part of its strategic culture that it loves arms control treaties, you know, so much that it wouldn't have to withdraw from the treaty. The other bad, so there are a lot of, including myself, a lot of, you know, people who have been studying these matters for years believe the Russians are in gross violation of the New START treaty and might have twice as many weapons on their strategic forces, at least twice as many as are permitted by the treaty. And the other bad thing about this, you know, you can extend the New START treaty quite easily without negotiation, just by exchanging diplomatic notes. Now, what does that imply for other things that clearly are violations of at least of the spirit, because Russia is in the process of deploying a whole new family of nuclear superweapons that aren't explicitly covered in the New START treaty, like the Poseidon torpedo, intercontinental torpedo that can carry a 100 megaton warhead and patrol up and down our coasts and is advertised by the Russians as being to raise radioactive tidal waves, or the Burisvestnik nuclear-powered nuclear cruise missile, you know, that they plan to deploy. Sarmat.
Hypersonic weapons as well, right?
Hypersonic warheads that are almost virtually invisible to our radar and greatly reduce the arrival time, so that we're basically more vulnerable to surprise attack and including EMP attack, because the hypersonic weapons fly at the optimum altitudes for making EMP attacks, by the way.
Peter, we were out of time before we've run out of things to talk with you about, alas. One other concern about this New START arrangement is, of course, it does not cover the Chinese threat at all. So we would be locking ourselves into a position of, I think, inferiority vis-a-vis the Russians. But it's worse because they partner up with the Chinese. And not least, our weapons are increasingly obsolete. Theirs are modern and, as you say, quite numerous. Much more for us to discuss with you in the near future, Peter Pry. Thank you for your warnings about this and pointing out the folly of some of the decisions being taken, perhaps to our really great peril, by the Biden-Harris administration. We'll come back to you for more soon. We'll come back to the rest of you, I hope, again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.